Good morning. It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday afternoon, a Dane County Circuit Court judge told the state of Wisconsin to put Governor Walker's budget repair bill on hold again. Since there are so many legal and political questions swirling around this issue, it seemed like a good idea to have both a political expert and a legal expert on the program to talk about those issues. So, here are my guests. First, Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at the UW-Milwaukee and frequent guest on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Good morning, professor, and welcome back.
Good morning, John, and please call me Mordecai.
All right, I will do that. Also joining me today is Peter Rofus, a professor of law, associate dean for academic affairs, and director for part-time legal education at Marquette University. Good morning, professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor Rofus, let's start with you. As I understand it, the original action that was brought by the Dane County District Attorney is asking for a determination of whether or not the passage of what we now know as Act 10 violated the state's open meeting laws and seeks to delay the publication of the law until the questions about its passage have been resolved. The Dane County Circuit Court ordered the Wisconsin Secretary of State not to publish the law pending a review of those other legal issues. Is that an accurate summary of the initial legal arguments?
It is. It tangles together a series of legal issues that needs to be untangled. But, yeah, that captures in part where we are right now.
Well, let's try to untangle a few of these things then. Obviously, there's more than one legal question here. The original question of whether or not the law was passed legally under the state's open meeting law. And then the other, another question in some minds is whether or not the Dane County Circuit Court has any jurisdiction.
Yeah, and actually, let's put an intermediate question in. First, was the law passed properly, consistent with the Wisconsin Constitution? Did the legislature follow the appropriate processes? Second, was the law published? The Constitution says that in order for a law to be in force, it must be published. We have a legal question as to publication. And finally, what you call jurisdiction, does the Circuit Court of Dane County have jurisdiction? And what some have called that, including some of the parties, might better be phrased, is it constitutionally or otherwise appropriate for a Circuit Court to get involved in the nitty-gritty of the legislative process? Does it have the authority to tell a coordinate branch of government that it did or did not properly enact a law? These are all part of the interconnected pieces of law that are at stake here.
Yeah, I got a headache pretty quickly when I started looking at this stuff. It took me back to the last law class I had, and that was some years ago.
And that's because law tends to be a little less exciting than politics. Law is in the details, that's why Mordecai has the upper hand here, because he gets to talk politics.
Well, Mordecai Lee, I wanted to look at the political dimension. I'd kind of like us to maybe frame some of the issues, and then we'll let our callers get into it, and we'll get into some of the details on the legal questions as we move ahead here. But let's look at the political dimension for just a moment. Act 10, very controversial piece of legislation. There are some risks to both political parties in how this whole thing has played out. Let's start out by talking about what the risks are for the Republicans in being seen as having circumvented a court order. What about the downside for them in this action?
John, let me just start out by saying that I think this is a fun pairing. You've got a law professor who's not been a lawmaker, and you've got a non-lawyer who has been a lawmaker. Now, if you put the two of us together, maybe you've got one expert here. I think from the political dimension, what we have to remember is that in sort of 21st century American politics, the key motivator is anger. I focus on sort of talk radio is a very much a right of center phenomenon, and talk radio very much engages in promoting anger by its audience, feeling that it's not being respected, it's not being served by the political system. And I think that that's what led to having a governor introduce this kind of legislation, and which led to a Republican legislature passing this kind of legislation. And ironically, what it did, in other words, serving the anger from the right, has created anger on the left to a point that I think most of us, whether we're law professors or radio hosts or someone like me, we're just astounded by the apparent deeply felt feelings on the left of the principle of collective bargaining. And so the developments in the last 2 months have been astounding, truly unbelievable.
Well, but what about the perception that, you know, it may be being created, and I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but just on the appearances, you have the state's attorney general and the Republicans in the legislature and the governor's office all saying, look, this law has been published, this is a done deal, the whatever this Madison court has to say, we don't even have to pay attention to.
You know, I'm guessing that Mr. Rofus, Professor Rofus, would flunk anybody who made that kind of argument, because the legal publication of a law engages with at least four characteristics. It has to be published in the Wisconsin State Journal, which has been designated as the official state newspaper. It has to be published in the legal notices section of the paper. It has to be published in the hard copy version of the paper. And that publication has to be authorized by the Secretary of State. I really think that a governor and the attorney general are overreaching here with such a stretch of an argument that it's really hard to keep a straight face. That I don't think in any way that what the LRB did on Friday of posting it on its website would be defined legally as publication. But beyond that, yesterday the judge made clear that she was ruling that the TRO, the temporary restraining order, would be extended to cover any action implementing the act. And then there's a quote from the Department of Justice saying that they disagreed with the governor. They thought the bill was now law and they were going to proceed. I have to say I'm really stunned by that development.
May I?
Well, Professor.
May I, Mr.
Yeah,
Munson,
go ahead.
Respond?
Sure, go ahead.
Professor, I'm known to be a tough grader, but contrary to what Professor Lee has said, I wouldn't flunk someone who came up with the legal analysis that Professor Lee has demeaned. And I want to go back to his opening comments. He started off by taking a slam at talk radio, which is wonderful given your audience. But it misses the point that the underlying act that we're not talking about, which appears to have astounded people, stunned people, is all that not surprising coming from a gubernatorial candidate and a governor whose politics have been known for a long time. So the notion that we're stunned about this, I find breathtaking. Number two, on the publication point, this is where I think it's very easy to be sloppy. I don't agree. I think it's a close question whether the law has been published. If one reads the combination of constitutional provisions and statutory provisions, the Secretary of State, within a day of getting an act, says to the Legislative Reference Bureau, here is the date of publication, and it's got to be no more than 10 days of the day the Secretary of State receives it. Here's the date. That all happened, and the Legislative Reference Bureau proceeded to publish it. It was not a party before the court, and I think it's an interesting, close, and by no means frivolous argument that the law has been published. And so whatever else we may say about the political motivations here, and I don't think we're doing justice to the motivations of the side that Professor Lee is apparently not on, it's very, very plausible that the legal conclusion will be made that this law has been published. Now, the court has enjoined enforcement of it, implementation of it, and that stays in effect until a higher court says, oops, you missed circuit court, or, okay, the law wasn't passed appropriately. I don't think a court's going to say that, by the way, and therefore it's not in effect.
Well, I guess this is turning into a debate, even though it wasn't planned to be. I want to assure Professor Rofus that I'm here to do nonpartisan analysis of politics, something that I've done routinely with John Munson and other hosts over the years. And I'm giving my interpretation of what's going on. I'm certainly not a talking head for any particular ideology and certainly do not take a predictable point of view.
And I respect that and I understand that. But the notion that I would flunk someone who came up with the legal analysis that appears to flow from the combination of constitutional and statutory provisions, that the law's been published. I simply want to go on record as saying, no, I wouldn't. In fact, it's possible that that person might get a much better grade than that.
Okay, then we'll change it. I'd flunk them if I were teaching public law. But it seems to me the law gives great respect to precedent and tradition and custom of government. And it has never happened before in the history of Wisconsin that a law became a law other than through publication under the supervision of the Secretary of State. And the LRB has never posted a bill and presumed that posting it online was publishing a law. So at the very least, this is a kind of a thousand-in-one stretch.
Well, hold on. I mean, the Secretary of State did do exactly what the Constitution and statutory provisions require him to do. He did, within one day of receiving the law, announce a publication date, and that's what he's got to do under the Constitution and statutes. So what's not clear to me, Professor Lee...
Mordecai. Please call me Mordecai.
Well, we're going back and forth between... given that our sons rode on a bus together to school for several years, maybe we should call each other Mordecai and Peter. But it isn't clear to me what you believe is the deep flaw in the analysis of those who say this law has been published. Is it the Secretary of State's rescission, withdrawal of his decision, his announcement of a publication date?
Well, the Secretary of State was prohibited by the TRO, the Temporary Restraining Order, from publishing the law. And apparently on Friday afternoon when he heard rumors that LRB was about to post it on its website, he sent them a letter very explicitly explaining that the temporary restraining order prevented the publication of the law, that he was restrained from publishing the law, and that he wanted to be sure the LRB understood that the law could not be published under the terms of the TRO.
Well, hold on. Many have argued, and I think if you look at the Constitution and the statutes, that the court forbade the Secretary of State from doing something that the Secretary of State doesn't have the authority to do anyway. The Secretary of State doesn't publish. It receives a bill, it announces a publication date, and the Legislative Reference Bureau is specifically mentioned in both Constitution and statutes. So it may be that
Wait,
a higher court
is going
to...
you're saying the LRB is mentioned in the state Constitution?
Turn to... I don't have it in front of me. The LRB, all the Secretary of State does is within a day of receiving an act, provide notice to the Legislative Reference Bureau, and give a designated date of publication. All that happened here, okay? That happened. And it happened before an injunction from the court said it shouldn't happen.
Well, the constitutional provision calls for the publication of laws. It does not refer to the LRB. LRB was created only about 100 years ago.
Right, and you're right. The Constitution says no law shall be in force until published. And then we turn to the statutes and we see how publication happens. Secretary of State doesn't do the publication. It begins the process of publication by getting the bill and within 24 hours saying, here's the date within 10 days that this bill will be published.
John, are you still there?
That's the Secretary of State's responsibility. And that happened here, and it happened before the court said to the Secretary of State, who may not be responsible for publishing, don't publish.
John,
yes, I'm still
guessing
here.
A better pairing between Peter and someone else would have been a lawyer who takes the other position, because you can see there are outer limits. Even though I was a lawmaker, there are some outer limits to legal arguments that I'm able to make in comparison to Peter.
Well, hang on a second. We need to take a break.
Mordecai, I'm just trying to balance. My comments go to presenting the arguments of those who appear to be on the opposite side of the side that you have presented. And I think part of our job is to lay out the arguments so that folks who are not lawyers, not political scientists, can grasp, separate and apart from the political brouhaha, what's at stake.
Well, there are some other legal questions here that I want to get to, and I also want to invite callers to join in, and so I'd better do that and earn my pay here this morning. I was just going to hop out to a local coffee emporium and grab a cup while you two guys talk, but someone would probably not be happy with me if I did that, which wouldn't necessarily be the first time that has happened. So we're going to take a quick break, but before we do that, I want to invite callers to join us. As you can tell, this is an incredibly complicated issue, probably one that when I was reading the newspaper accounts and so forth, and listening to various reporters talk about this, I was hearing them and I was reading the struggles that reporters have when covering complicated legal questions like this. And so that's one reason why we're spending this hour trying to parse some of this stuff out and get into the nitty gritty so that people can understand that, hey, there really, you know, there are a number of ways to look at this. And that's what we do here on the Ideas Network. Okay, so if you'd like to weigh in on all of this and on the politics, because I want Mordecai Lee to talk about some other political issues here. And I also want Professor Rofus to deal with some of the other legal questions beyond whether it was published or not. And we'll come back and do those in a moment. But here's how you can be involved in the program. The toll-free number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, the address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook. Leave a comment there, and someone will pass it along to me, and I'll share it with the listening audience. So you have lots of ways to ask your questions here on the Kathleen Dunn program. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 25 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking, about Act 10, the budget repair bill, and some legal questions and some political questions that are swirling around this issue. A Dane County Circuit Court judge yesterday told the state of Wisconsin to put that law on hold until some legal questions about its passage can be determined. We're talking about some of those legal questions this hour and also the political dimension. And I have a pair of guests who are just making my job here this morning incredibly easy. I won't even have to get to the 3 pages of questions I wrote. My guests are Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at the UW-Milwaukee, and Peter Rofus, professor of law at Marquette University. Okay, now, Professor Rofus, there's another legal issue here beyond the issue of who published what and when, and that is the question brought by the Dane County District Attorney as to whether or not the passage of Act 10 was legal was a violation of the state's open meetings law. Wisconsin has a pretty strict open meetings law, and there are a lot of ways that you can trip yourself up in state government if you don't follow all of the details, all the nitty gritty of that. Can you speak to that legal issue for a moment, and then I want to go back to Mordecai about some political questions.
Well, the truth is, I said to your producer, I can't speak in depth about that legal issue. I'm not an expert on the open meetings law. We know about the special session argument. We know the purpose of the open meetings law is to ensure open government, that folks know what's being voted on, et cetera, et cetera. Much beyond that, the technical legal arguments about the open meetings laws are not ones that I'm an expert on. And I ultimately suspect that when we get to the bottom of this, that I truly wonder if that issue is ever going to be addressed.
Go ahead.
Like Peter, I'm definitely not an expert in the open meeting law. But I thought what was really interesting is that after the circuit judge had issued the temporary restraining order, and the Department of Justice requested of the Court of Appeals permission to appeal the TRO. I don't think I'm using the correct technical language, and I hope Peter will correct me. And the Court of Appeals declined to invite an appeal for the TRO, but passed it up to the state Supreme Court. And in the document, when they were passing it up to the state Supreme Court, they very interestingly addressed themselves to the major cases that both parties were citing. And the Court of Appeals found that there were two or three cases that clearly were on the side of the position argued by the Department of Justice concerning the open meetings law and the intervention in the legislative process. And there are two or three later cases that seem to argue for the side of the Dane County District Attorney. And so they were expressing a kind of substantive opinion that this was an arguable case, this was a close case, and that I do hope that the state Supreme Court will take it up, because I think along the lines of what Peter was saying, we would benefit by having the court give us some kind of interpretation about that.
Well, and I agree with all that, Mordecai. The irony, of course, and I suspect this is where we are going next in the conversation, is that all this is unfolding, 6 days before an election to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in which an incumbent and a challenger are having the sort of typical nasty exchanges, but this issue has been inserted, bingo, right in the middle. I do suspect that when the dust settles, it is the highest court of this state, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that will have its last say on some aspect of this question. That could be that the court system and separation of powers preclude us from intervening and making determinations about certain things that the legislature did. It could be saying that the open meetings law was violated and we have to go all the way back to the beginning and do the whole thing over again. But I suspect we're going to turn to the impact of this on what's happening next Tuesday.
Yes, and you are prescient. I mean, that's exactly where I was going to go next. However, before I do that, I wanted to ask one more legal question. And that is, for now anyway, I'll maintain my right to ask further legal questions later in the program.
Duly noted.
This reminds me of a research paper I had to write once. I'm getting a terrible headache. Who enforces the state's open meeting law? For example, I mean, in this case, this is a state law. So if the local city council in Superior, Wisconsin did something that violated the state's open meeting law and someone complained to the Douglas County District Attorney, that attorney would act to enforce the state law and would investigate to see if a crime had actually been committed. Is that what happened? Is that the process that is that I'm assuming is in place for this? Or if the state legislature is perceived by someone to have violated state law, does that prosecution have to come from the state attorney general's office?
I thought where you were headed with the question was, don't courts have the authority ultimately to make decisions about whether a legislative body has violated the open meetings law? Sure. The state legislature was accused in circuit court of violating the open meetings law. And courts, judges, are here to apply law to facts. So this is the way our system often works. We've become a culture in which whoever loses in the political process goes to the judiciary. another branch of government and says, we want another kick at the can. And this is one of the strongest arguments that those who lost in the political process can muster, and that is the violation of open meetings laws. And sure, courts have authority in general to enforce violations of that law.
All right, now let's go back to the political question, and Mordecai, we'll start with you this time. As Professor Rofe has pointed out, you know, we are about 6 days away from an election for a state Supreme Court justice. Talk about how this case and the whole, well, let me ask you this. Is this Supreme Court election going to be a referendum on the budget repair bill?
Yes. I've always wanted to do a one-word answer on public radio.
Thank you, Senator Mansfield. Moving on.
It's been transformed by the events surrounding it into a referendum on the collective bargaining bill. It's been pretty much, in a sense, kidnapped from the candidates and taken over by these larger forces.
Well, I know that, you know, just looking at signage and so forth, at least from one side, the signs say, "Stop Governor Walker, vote for Kloppenburg." Is that a risky strategy?
John, I think a couple things are at play here. One of them is, to me, this is Exhibit A, why we should not elect justices. But, you know, that sort of water over the dam, the founding writers of the Constitution decided that for the state of Wisconsin. I think the question is, if the mobilization on the left against the law will in any way translate into sort of the footsteps of voters going into polling places. I don't think that's necessarily the case. Generally speaking, for a spring election, we'd have about a 20% turnout. Generally speaking, it would be what politicians would call hardcore voters, in other words, higher than average education, higher than average age, and higher than average income. So I'm not positive that there's going to be a flocking to the polls by the people who are concerned about the bill, but it is possible that this will be a stunning election.
Well, what about this? And I read there was somebody, one of the political blogs or a commentator in a newspaper. Sometimes they're hard to tell one from the other. And we won't. That's an entirely different show. I don't even want to go down that rabbit path. So, but I did read somebody was doing some political analysis and indicated that, number one, you've got an election for county executive in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Because Scott Walker vacated that post when he became the governor. And second, you also have a county executive election in Dane County because Kathleen Falk suddenly said, I'm not going to do this anymore. And so those are a pair of very normally heavily Democratic counties.
Is
the turnout in those areas going to affect what happens with the state Supreme Court race?
Right. That was an analysis piece by Craig Gilbert in the Journal Sentinel. I thought it was an excellent piece. But it seems to me that while perhaps one can make a generalization that Dane County is a Democratic county, I don't think we can make that generalization anymore about Milwaukee County, especially in terms of county executive races. Because while it's true that it had been in the past a safely Democratic county, both in nonpartisan and in partisan races, I think that Scott Walker, when he first ran for county executive, and he was a sitting Republican state assemblyman, I think he really shattered that mold, and his reelection races further reinforced that. So I don't think we should assume necessarily that Democrats would be advantaged by the county executive race in Milwaukee County.
What about Dane County?
Yes, I think they would very, very much be advantaged in Dane County.
Well, I guess given the low turnout, it seems to me that you could make the case that it wouldn't take a whole lot to tip this election one way or the other.
Right, and this gets to this issue of mobilization. You know, the generalization we've made about the results of the November 10 election was that the turnout level was about average, but that there was a higher than average turnout in Republican counties and a lower than average turnout in Democratic counties. In other words, Republicans were excited and Democrats were demoralized. I don't think this is quite the mirror image, but it's possible we'll see something along those lines, like your illustration of Dane County.
All right. Well, let's. I want to give the phone number again and let people know how they can get involved. Maybe people are having a difficult time coming up with questions. I've got pages of this stuff, but we'll just use mine then. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's the number. You can get in right now. The lines are wide open. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook and leave a comment there or a question, and we'll pass it on to the listener. Okay, I'm told that we have phones. Well, my screen doesn't show any calls. Okay, let's strike one for technology. I don't see any of the names, and so I'll rely on my producers to pick one and tell me who it is. Let's start with Gary in Wausau.
Morning. The judge yesterday made it pretty clear that the order applies to governmental agencies like the Legislative Reference Bureau that are not parties. After the hearing, an assistant attorney general walked out and told the press that the order did not apply to the Department of Administration. Don't you think that he is subject to a contempt citation?
I'm guessing that question's addressed to me. And I think what's unfolding here is that the judge, and she said this explicitly, grasped that her initial order either was worded slightly inelegantly and or was perceived by folks who weren't before the court as not binding on them, which most orders aren't. Yesterday, the court made clear that a further implementation of the law is to be stopped. And we're pushing toward kind of a mini constitutional crisis between a couple branches of government. Although I'm not sure how I stand on the contempt notion, I do think were I advising clients in this matter, I wouldn't publicly say I'm going to ignore the judge's order. This is generally not wise for individuals or entities to say. So I do agree with the caller. At the same time, we have a deeper question as to the legal status of where the issue is right now. I would not encourage folks at anywhere in Wisconsin government to say aloud that, hey, what the judge said, we're going to ignore that. This is not a thing that folks ought to do.
Gary, thanks for the call. Let's go to Peter in Milwaukee next. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm enjoying the program immensely. I am more of a conservative, and I don't see the conservatives being demoralized about this. When you have anti-Walker slogans that are pushing for Kloppenburg, and then you got Kloppenburg radio ads saying that she's unbiased and she's the one who's going to look at things carefully, I have to laugh out loud when I hear that and say, how ridiculous can this be? Apparently people are thinking she's not going to be unbiased ahead of time. And so I really enjoy the legal banter. I heard another Marquette legal professor say the same thing as your guest, lawyer Peter there. He agreed, and yet the other side, represented by Mordecai, thinks that you get an F or a D for thinking that way, and it's just ironic how little information is actually out there on this case, and people are making up their minds without being informed.
I'll start the conversation, and Peter might want to comment too. I think the most significant thing that I heard from Peter, the caller, was that he considers himself on the right, and he does not feel that the right is demoralized in terms of the upcoming election. And that's a real sort of flash news from the grassroots. And if that's the case, then I suspect that demography wins. In the sense of in a 20% turnout election, the voters would probably skew right of center, whereas in high turnout elections, they would skew left of center. So based on Peter's familiarity with the grassroots, then that helps make a prediction about the election result.
Well,
Professor Rumphus?
Let me go back to something Mordecai said earlier and try to touch base with the most recent caller's comments. There seems to be an assumption running around, and there are even those on the right who have articulated this, that somehow after the election of November 2010, which swept Republicans into office and have governors around the state, around the country doing things not unlike what Governor Walker is doing, that somehow Governor Walker overreached and there is going to be a huge boomerang effect that we are going to see perhaps as early as next Tuesday. My sense is different, and we don't have time to talk about judicial elections generally, but my sense is, first of all, it's difficult to topple an incumbent. Second, however pathetic the race has been thus far, and I've watched, I think, four debates, and it has been pathetic, and part of that is inherent in the judicial election process, but it's inherent in every process we select judges. I suspect that there is, and I hate to use this phrase because it harkens back to President Nixon, I suspect there is a silent majority of folks around the state, not in Milwaukee and Dane County, who cast their vote for Governor Walker in November and are eager to show that they haven't changed their minds and are going to cast their vote for Justice Prosser to the extent they believe this election is a referendum, unfortunately, on the collective bargaining issue. So I'm eager to see what happens next Tuesday, but my own sense is that despite all of the loudness, all of the protest, all of the activity on the left, and the fact that Mayor Tom Barrett is a fabulous public servant and a terrific guy, I suspect if the election were held tomorrow for governor, that Scott Walker would once again prevail. I don't know if Mordecai agrees with that, but I certainly do. And I would be surprised. I'm not sure it's going to happen next Tuesday, but I would be surprised if there were an overwhelmingly large turnout that catapulted the challenger into office.
Here's the problem with having two professors, especially one from the legal side and one from the lawmaking side. We always want to be sure that the record is accurate. And so I just want to add to what Peter, not the caller, Peter, the guest, said. I did not say that introducing the bill and passing the bill was an overreach. I said that the claim that it was published by LRB was an overreach.
No, and Mordecai, I wasn't citing you.
Oh, okay.
There are folks all around the state, all around the country, who believe that, for instance, the governor has overreached because for some reason this particular issue was not flagged in the election, and therefore the executive had no authority. Somehow the people of Wisconsin were not on notice of what was going to happen, that this is an overreach in that respect.
Okay.
I agree with your clarification of the record. I am not suggesting that you've indicated the governor has overreached by prompting the enactment of the law.
Fair enough.
We need to take a break. Just ahead of that, I'll just toss in what one of my political science professors always used to tell me, and that is elections aren't about issues. They're about which candidate gets their supporters to the polls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Lines are full right now, but there'll be a line opening up for you. We'll try to get to as many calls as we can before the top of the hour. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. And this hour, we're talking about all the legal and political issues swirling around the implementation of Act 10, which was the budget repair bill passed by the legislature. And now we've got a little bit of a telephone problem here. I think we need to get rid of one line. Let me reintroduce my two guests, and then we'll go back to some more calls. Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at the UW-Milwaukee, and Peter Rofus, professor of law at Marquette University. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Alan in Medford next. Hello, Alan. Go ahead. Oops, we lost Alan. All right, well, let me try and capture Alan's question because it was a good one. What do we lose? What do we lose by waiting to implement the law until we've had a chance to discuss some of the legal issues surrounding it, such as whether or not the passage violated the open meetings law? And Mordecai, why don't you go first and then Professor Rofus? Yeah, Mordecai, you go first.
Okay. I think that it's understandable why the administration would be eager to begin implementing the law, and this has to do with really the eye-glazing details of government. After all, the budget repair bill was intended to cut expenditures by state government through to the end of this fiscal year, which is June 30th of 11, so that the budget would end up being relatively balanced. And so it was only intended to be for the last quarter of the fiscal year. And the last quarter of the fiscal year begins on Friday morning, on April Fool's Day, but also the first day of the quarter. And therefore, for them to save the amount of money in terms of changing the amounts that are contributed by public employees, their calculations are based on it being in effect for the entire quarter. And so it's certainly understandable from the perspective of public administration why they're so eager to get this going.
Well, let me toss this out then, and because this is a question that I haven't really heard discussed all that much. Maybe I just haven't been paying attention enough. It's sometimes been difficult to continue to pay attention. What does the collection of union dues have to do with the state budget?
Well, that, of course, has been the key political argument. The left is arguing that the money that the governor wanted to save could have been accomplished without affecting those details of collective bargaining, and the right responds that it's sort of part of a package.
Well, I'm speaking as a radical moderate. to me that if the claim is being made that this is about the budget, then I haven't heard anyone make a what I have thought of as a cogent argument as to what who collects what dues and how they do it has to do with saving the state money. It seems more of a political and policy question than anything else. I just want people to say what things are, but then, you know, I probably am living in the wrong country for that. Let's go back to the phones. And Professor Rofus, we have you back on. We lost you for just a moment.
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover jumped in and cut me off.
Yeah, well, you know, let's blame everything on Hoover. He's dead. He can't sue us. Let's go to Fred in Wisconsin Rapids next. Fred, thanks for joining us.
I'm cut off.
Who's cut off?
No, you're on.
Am I on? Oh, hi, guys.
You're on, Fred.
But I got through. I'm actually a Kloppenberg supporter. I've wrote 14 letters to the editor to all the newspapers across the state. Back in the early 60s when I graduated, one of my poli sci professors always said, in a democracy, it's good for one party not to control all branches of government. And here in Wisconsin, we've got all three branches controlled overwhelmingly, plus the Attorney General is a Republican, and plus the Supreme Court is is conservative. So I think you need some kind of balance. The other thing with Prosser is his demeanor. There's so much conflict on the court. I'm just astounded that he called the Chief Justice the B word, and I just don't think a person like that, no matter a Democrat or a Republican, should hold that kind of post. That's my comments.
I'd like to respond to the two separate points.
Go ahead.
One is, I am a fan of divided government in general, although I find it, of course, ironic that the folks who plead for divided government almost invariably are the folks whose party is out of power. When Democrats control the State House, the legislature, and the highest court. We don't hear pleas from the left for divided government. And same thing on the right. We're not hearing Republicans argue for divided government. I want to pass on the caller's characterization of the court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, as conservative, because we don't have the time for that. As far as Justice Prosser's qualifications for being on the court and the use of the B word toward the Chief Justice, I think the biggest mistake that Justice Prosser made in that regard was not simply apologizing publicly early. Each of us makes mistakes in every business, in every office, in every organization. Professionals do things that are unprofessional. We do know he directed a gender-based slur at the female Chief Justice, and irrespective of what prompted it, were I advising him, instead of backing off of it for a couple of days before saying I'm sorry, I would have said, frankly, I made a mistake. I acted unprofessionally. It won't happen again. Does that single episode disqualify him from holding an office? Not so sure, because if we use that standard, I wonder how many folks could be in public office, how many of us could keep our jobs, so on down the line.
Could I jump in?
Sure, go ahead.
I want to address this issue of divided government versus non-divided government. Actually, I'm not a fan of divided government. I think the American governmental system, just by its very nature and its very structure and its constitutional restrictions, is oriented to sort of inaction or delay or inability to make important and big decisions. And when you've got divided government, it is gridlock. Sort of nothing gets done. I like undivided government, first of all, because it can potentially overcome the constitutional limitations, but also because it gives a party a chance to do what it says it believes in. And then when the next election comes around, people can say, well, this party was in the majority, and here's what their record is, and if I like them, I'm going to vote for them again. If I don't like their record, I'll vote for the other party. It's much neater and cleaner. There's a much more clear accountability than being able to sort of alibi out, well, it's not my fault because of X, Y, Z.
All right, we have another caller, and I think this may be the last caller we get to here, but let's take Bill in Adams because I think he has a really interesting question. Bill, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, I can barely hear you. I don't know if you can hear me.
We hear you just fine. Bill, go ahead.
Okay, I can just barely hear you, so I will go, but thank you for taking my phone call. My question is this. If the Department of Administration goes ahead and proceeds, even after the judge said don't do it, can the state employees file a class action suit or an individual suit because of them implementing it and taking monies off their check without proper authorization? And what about the unions? Can they also file a suit saying, hey, this law really hasn't been approved yet, and we could end up with a whole legal battle that will go on for years? So my question is, can that happen?
Yeah, the great thing about your question, Bill, is that you phrased it in such a way that it does give rise, as Mordecai was joking about earlier, to a single-word answer, and that is yes. Of course.
And that may be all we have time for.
Any question that begins, can so-and-so file a lawsuit? Employees with class action, unions, of course. We live in a society in which folks are filing lawsuits left and right, and only on TV can a judge, and I saw this a couple of nights ago on one of my favorite shows, stop a plaintiff from filing a lawsuit even before it is filed, only on television. So yes is the answer to your question. Of course, a series of lawsuits can and will be filed if the implementation of this law goes forward. Of that, we can be absolutely certain.
So, What's next in this little drama? I don't have time to really get into this a lot, but let me ask you, Mordecai, another question you may be able to answer with one word. Is the atmosphere in the legislature now so poisonous that it's going to be impossible for Democrats and Republicans to cooperate on anything?
No, I don't think so. I think politicians are relatively cold-blooded and pragmatic people, and if they want to cooperate, they can.
All right. Well, you know what? We're out of time. We could do this again. I had a lot of fun. I don't know about you guys, but I really enjoyed this hour. This was outstanding radio. Thank you to both of you for supplying us with your views and opinions this morning. I appreciate you being on the program today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, and thanks to Mordecai as well.
You too, Peter.
Peter Rofus, professor of law at Marquette University, and Mordecai Lee, governmental affairs professor at the UW-Milwaukee. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, on-air production by Chrissy Pease and Katie Mattson. Thanks to them for making my job easy. Stick around. We have another hour of programming coming up here on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about the merger of AT&T and T-Mobile. Good idea, bad idea, what does it mean for consumers going forward? Stick around, I'll be back after the news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.